This is an alternative universe.
See, there aren't any textbooks that teach about these principles.
It's dangerous if the government gets in the business of propaganda.
We need journalistic integrity now more than ever.
Warning, you're listening to the Agenda 31 podcast with Corey Ive and Todd McGreevy.
The thing, remember, names are for things.
That is why the United States respects the sovereignty of the British people and their right of self-determination.
For good reasons, we don't want the government to be the lead on that.
Due to the unique division of political authority in the United States, U.S. citizens are residents in every state and should not attempt to copy the strategies employed by the hosts of the Agenda 31 broadcast without first consulting legal counsel.
Do you have a license for this?
Motivation. What is my motivation?
Because, I'm not okay with slavery, just so we're clear.
As a U.S. citizen, you just don't own anything. You're just a user, and the government owns everything. And the assumption is everybody's a U.S. citizen.
You know, you're going to have to shut up or I'm going to have you arrested.
First, I need to make sure Nicole is safe, so I need you to protect her.
Right, so go ask your government.
I can't.
Why not?
Because someone in the government's working with the terrorists.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Agenda 31. This is your co-host, Todd McGreevy, and I'm being joined by...
Corey Ibe. Greetings, Todd.
In the morning to you, Corey. Welcome, everybody, to episode number 121 of Agenda 31. We are doing this live at agenda31.org/stream on February 26, 2017, an early Sunday morning out there on the left coast, waving a hand from the Scott County, Iowa, overlooking the banks of the Mississippi River. Corey?
We are now called the Drenched Coast, Todd.
Oh, excellent. The Drenched Coast. I like that.
Everybody,
you are tuned in to the lowest risk, highest reward podcast in the universe, where we get on the table Article 4, Section 2, state citizenship, like nobody else. So thank you for checking us out at Agenda 31. We have a packed show today, Corey. And I want to circle back to a couple things I promised I would deal with last episode.
Awesome.
And that includes the Meetup Resist deal. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, you mentioned that last week.
Yeah.
I didn't really look into that, so I'm looking forward to
so
meetup, more info.
Meetup.com or meetup.org, which one is it? I can't remember. Anyway,
I'm pretty sure it's a .com.
Yeah, and I've used it for years locally here in the Quad Cities, Iowa, Illinois market. And Super Liberty was the first meetup I ever did, and that's where I met a lot of the people that I'm still good friends with that have worked hard to hold government accountable where we live on every front, from grand jury to sheriff to, protesting in the streets. And that's, Meetup's been a really good tool. It's like $5 a month or, $50 a year or something like that. And somebody always, kind of uses their credit card to manage it. And I've been an admin of numerous ones, from fighting the fluoride in the water to there's a backyard chicken one I'm a member of to stay up, and you get everything on Meetup from, hot yoga to, people who like to hike in the woods. It doesn't have to be political in order to use Meetup. It's a social networking tool.
Right. I'm part of a group that is a square dancing group.
Really?
Seriously. Yeah.
There you go. See, they about 2 or 3 weeks ago, they posted a blog posting that said hashtag resist. For almost 15 years, Meetup has served as an organizing platform for a wide range of political parties and movements, welcoming everyone from the Howard Diniacs to the Tea Party. We're vital plumbing for democracy, we always said. Before today, our company had never taken a partisan stance. It's not a decision we take lightly, but after Donald Trump's order to block people on the basis of nationality and religion, a line had been crossed. At a time when core democratic ideals felt under attack, we looked at our members' response and were inspired by meetups like SF Resist, San Francisco. We felt the duty to spark more activity and broaden civic participation. As champions of democracy, equality, human rights, social justice, and sustainability, ding, more people than ever are ready to organize, take to the streets, visit town hall meetings, pick up the phone, paint signs, and huddle to make their voices heard. We are a meetup, damn it. We needed to act. So last week, we stopped normal operations for a company-wide hackathon, a resistathon, to help people get involved. We created 1,000+ hashtag resist meetup groups to act as local hubs for these actions. We launched 1,000 meetup groups free for everyone. We're announcing them to our 30 million members. We made key product changes, enabling anyone to schedule local meetups. We partner with leading organizations to distribute their ideas for making change. It's time to defend our democracies and restore values of inclusivity, love, tolerance, and respect. One helping hand, one voice, one meetup at a time. Find a Resist meetup near you. It goes on to say, we're not operating alone. It's up to the people to take this forward. We're lucky to have partners including the Women's March, Human Rights March, Planned Parenthood, the Anti-Defamation League, and many others who are contributing to our library of ideas for making change. So many a person sent me a note about this, and of course, a handful of them said, Soros bought him out! Corey,
can you hear me?
I can hear you. Did you miss all that?
I missed the probably about the last 40 seconds. My machine just completely locked up.
That's no fun.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, did you get the gist of the Resist thing happening with Meetup?
I did. Well, make sure I understand it correctly. It was actually Meetup that set up these different Resist meetups, right?
Yes, they took a very overt public stand against Donald Trump and for the, I don't know, I guess the other side, you know, the proverbial partisan class. They've chosen sides. They used to be equal opportunity service providers to the DNIACs and the Tea Partiers, and now they're fully behind the Resist people so much that they've populated 1,000 Resist meetup groups. So they've seeded the marketplace with just come in and grab one, and you can be the Resist guy where you live.
Well, I'm sure there's plenty of libtards in the area that will grab those here in California.
Well, what was interesting, I went and checked out the ones that were around, you know, my area, if you will, and I just joined them. I'm like, sure, I'll see what's going on. I mean, you know, I had a couple people like, I'm not using Meetup anymore, and they, you know, they're so pissed off they opted out, and I thought it was kind of, you know, well, okay, maybe for I don't know. Everybody has their own personal reasons, but to me, I'm more about. Give me more data. I like to see what's going on. Who thinks they're doing what? So I'm aware. I don't just want to. Anyway, it's an interesting little dynamic that is indicative of the times we live in, I think.
I find it amazing that the left is really the establishment. And I mean, for 8 years, it's been very socialized programs, very, you know, everything's mainstream kind of socialism. And the idea of Resist, I don't know, I just find it funny. And big companies like this that are sticking their toe in politics, it's just not smart because you're going to, you know, you're cutting off a whole huge portion. Like the whole job of Meetup is to provide an area for people to, you know, use the website the way it is. And for the owners of the website to think, hey, it's a really good idea to, you know, to create this whole network of Resist meetups, to me, that seems really foolish as far as a business, like to openly do that, because there's a whole bunch of people you're going to offend.
Well, it's not foolish if you're getting a subsidy check from some advocate and or patron is the word I was looking for. If you have a patron, hey. It might not
be foolish in the short term, but that patron check, that I don't think that's going to last. And once you lose trust, I mean, if you start pushing and people want to create their own competition to Meetup where that idea wouldn't have been there, I don't know. Just to me, it doesn't seem like a good business decision. The job of Meetup is to provide meetups, not foster resistance to one particular political party. That's just my opinion. I from a business standpoint, I think that's kind of foolish.
Speaking of the resistance to one particular party, I don't know if you've noticed lately, but the term fascist is being bandied about just ad nauseum.
Yes.
It's just thrown at the wall by every social justice warrior you can shake a stick at. And,
you know, I read a book a while back, a long time ago, about, oh my gosh, who was in charge? Who was the prime minister of Great Britain during World War II?
Churchill.
I'm pretty sure, maybe somebody can check me on this, but I'm pretty sure that Winston Churchill said on Victory Over Europe Day, when the Nazis had the one general had tendered the surrender mm-hmm. of the Nazi, you know, the German army, that he said in the future, the anti-fascists will be the fascists.
Huh.
I seem to remember
that's
that.
Fascinating. Because that's what I was thinking as I was reading what I was ready to read to everybody here.
I figured that's where you're going with it, because it's so obvious.
So, you know, I published a newspaper, the River Cities Reader, rcreader.com, been publishing it for 23 plus years, independent journalism here in Iowa and Illinois. And we pick up commentaries that are from various suppliers like, you know, Lou Rockwell to Jacob Hornsberger's organization, Future Freedom Foundation, to Thomas Knapp with the libertarian think tank he has. I've mentioned many of their articles. There's another site called the FEE, Foundation for Economic Education, FEE.org. A fabulous website, extremely well produced. And I picked up an article recently for the lead in this current week's online, How Fascism Became the Political Boogeyman by Trevor Chase. And he writes, with the rise of the political right in both Europe and America, the word fascism is everywhere. It's not just everywhere in print, but shouted across college campuses by furious youth, traded as gossip in cafes, flung across the floor of the Irish Senate, and spammed almost daily at the Huffington Post. So what does it mean? Orwell's attempt to answer this question in his landmark 1944 essay, What is Fascism?, lamented the transformation of fascism as a system of government and economics into little more than a swear word. He observed that you will find that there is almost no set of people, certainly no political party, organized body of any kind, which has not been denounced as fascist during the past 10 years. So he goes on to say how it began, and he says it did once have a meaning. The word fascism was born from the fascist party, the leader of which was Benito Mussolini, who invented the word himself. Look no further than the designer of the system. Mussolini was the fascist, and his essay, The Doctrine of Fascism, lays the definition out more plainly than we could ask for. So I'll put a link to it at the show notes. There is a website called worldfuturefund.org, which purports to have the only translation in English of the full essay that Mussolini wrote about fascism. And here, let me try and get this in the chat room too so people can see it for themselves. Here you go, everybody. And let me get to the top of this here. There was a comment in here. It's no mechanical device. Yeah. And as I read this, and it's worth a read, frankly, one of the headers is, are you still with me, Corey?
I'm here.
Rejection of individualism and the importance of the state. Fascism is therefore opposed to all individualistic abstractions based on 18th century materialism, and it is opposed to all Jacobinistic utopias and innovations. It does not believe in the possibility of happiness on earth as conceived by the economist literature of the 18th century, and it therefore rejects the theological notion that at some future time the human family will secure a final settlement of all its difficulties. So as I read through this, I'm thinking to myself, okay, you're a social justice warrior, you're a talking head on these inane cable shows where nothing actually gets resolved, and you keep throwing this term out about Donald Trump, and he's a fascist, and his supporters are fascists. And I'm just trying to, you know, you think of your Donald Trump supporter that you know, Corey, and think of this definition. Let's see if it comports. This notion runs counter to experience, which teaches that life is in continual flux and in process of evolution. In politics, fascism aims at realism. In practice, it desires to deal only with those problems which are the spontaneous product of historic conditions and which find or suggest their own solutions. Only by entering into the process of reality and taking possession of the forces at work within it can man act on man and on nature. Anti-individualistic, the fascist conception of life stresses the importance of the state, with a capital S, and accepts the individual only insofar as his interests coincide with those of the state, which stands for the conscience and the universal will of man as a historic entity. Whatever the F that means. But, you know, I mean, right there, individualism is subservient to the interest of the state, with a capital S, the entity of the state.
Yeah, that at the time of the revolution, right after that, you know, there was the French Revolution. And you mentioned the Jacobinistic. You used that term, Jacobinistic.
Benito did.
Benito. I was saying that you were referencing that a second ago. But that was a Democratic club that started right after the revolution in the United States. That started in Paris, in France. And their whole thing was the exact opposite. Here, the revolution was about the individual. George Washington said it's a bad thing to start political parties. It was all about, the government was here to protect the individual. France went the opposite way, and the Jacobins, they really led it down the way of it being the everybody is subservient to the state. Very, very different views. And I thought that
I presume the state was a new entity to those individuals because they were used to dealing with a monarchy or a royalty or kings or queens or and so the state was a different type of animal perhaps.
The state in France was more of that everybody looked up to the state. The all authority was inherent in the state. The individual had no authority other than if the individual's goals were in line to further the state. And it was very, very socialistic, democratic, democracy type viewpoint in Paris, whereas the United States went a very different route. Now today, these people that are bantering about, the fascism and really pushing for socialism, they remind me a lot of the Jacobinists of Paris.
Oh yeah. I just think that the term is, because Trump is saying America first and his supporters are trying to be more, less globalist and more nationalist. Yeah. That gives the other side, so to speak, the open door to say, you're all about the state. And I think it's just a painting with a huge broad brush. I don't see I guess if you're a social justice warrior and you point to the guy that is the former head of Exxon is now the Secretary of State, you could see where you have a concern of the collapse of corporatism with government and calling that fascism, because it's the state serving the desires of corporatism, and so that's where the state it's fascinating. I'm not sure that they're the same thing of what Mussolini was trying to talk about. I'm not sure. But
it's certainly something that no matter who's in office, I don't care if it's your mom that holds the office of the president, the people are not supposed to trust the president. They're supposed to hold him in check.
Right.
And the amount of power that the president has, you always have to be worried about, elements of fascism, the marriage of corporate interests with government control. You have to be concerned. You have to be on the lookout for that because that's just the natural progression. I think the use of it today by most of the people that just seem butthurt about the election are, incorrect in the way that they're just describing fascism to anything that they don't agree with. But I oftentimes people think like call me a Donald Trump supporter. I think we dodged a bullet not having Hillary Clinton in office. But I don't care who's in office. I expect them to do their job, and I don't trust them.
Mussolini goes on to write, fascist state as a spiritual force. The fascist state, as a higher and more powerful expression of personality, is a force, but a spiritual one. It sums up all the manifestations of the moral and intellectual life of man. Its functions cannot therefore be limited to those of enforcing order and keeping the peace, as the liberal doctrine had it. It is no more mechanical device for defining the sphere within which the individual may duly exercise his supposed rights. The fascist state is an inwardly accepted standard and rule of conduct, a discipline of the whole person. It permeates the will no less than the intellect. It stands for a principle which becomes the central motive of a man as a member of civilized society, sinking deep down into his personality. It dwells in the heart of the man of action and of the thinker, of the artist and of the man of science, soul of the soul.
Well, I think he pretty much, fascism, if according to Mussolini, is that, this is not about the sphere within which the individual exercises supposed rights, which that sphere he's mentioning is what we're asserting is
called a Republican form of government, the Republican state government.
Yes.
Which defines how you can exercise your rights and how your rights are defended. Not granted, not provided, not elicited, but acknowledged guaranteed. And
yes.
That is revolutionary. That is a revolutionary thought, that the role of the state is to provide us a sphere where those rights are guaranteed. Over and over, Corey, I keep hearing judges from the bench in different clips of different various, you know, whether it's a actual footage of a judge or a fictional presentation on a drama show, of granting rights. These judges truly believe they are there to grant rights.
Well, if they're, you know, presiding over a controversy involving a U.S. citizen, they're correct.
All right. Well, that, on that note, I'm going to take you to have you heard about this HBO documentary called Unlocking the Cage?
No.
Yeah. Let me play this for you. This is the trailer, and I think it does a better job of explaining it than I could. And we'll just get this on the Barbie here. Hold on. I'm going to plug this in. Here we go. Here we go.
These animals are extraordinarily cognitively complex. So when you imprison a chimpanzee, the chimpanzee understands that tomorrow he's going to be in prison. And as far as he knows, it's not going to end. What we're trying to do is change the way people view non-human animals. Because right now, it's, are you a human? You have rights. You're not a human, you don't. And we're saying that's wrong.
Now to a bizarre lawsuit with big implications, and the key question is whether a chimp is a person.
Tommy is a legal thing right now and has a right to get out of being held for his entire life in a cage.
When I began, people laughed at me and they barked when I went into a courtroom.
We are not human beings, and putting them on the same legal standing as a human being, that's insanity.
So we may be coming to you to help us in filing an affidavit, talking about the cognitive abilities that would persuade courts.
Question. Visitors have
balls. Oh, my God.
Merlin died last night.
Captivity, it's just killing these guys. So we need to locate every surviving chimpanzee in New York State and file a suit on their behalf.
Someone told me you had a monkey.
There's a chimp in there. He's got TV to watch.
Yeah, he won't do much. He just sits there.
Please, the court. Tommy is indeed a person who is entitled.
You assert he's a person. We haven't decided that.
All we can do is kick the first door open.
Mr. Wise, you want to come to our court and ask for a right that's never been granted in the history of humankind.
It's a hell of a war. It's going to be a lot of battles in the war. But it's time to begin.
There you go. You heard the judge with the gavel. Granting rights. You're asking us to grant a right that's never been granted. So have you heard about this at all?
I have, yeah. And there's a whole, not only for animals, but there's also a whole push for rights for
plants?
Artificial intelligence electronics.
Yeah, it's a rabbit hole. And this is not a new story. I'm looking at the hard copy of the New York Times Magazine somebody gave me back from April of 2014. I've had this sitting in my library here for some time. Never really picked it up, just... Yeah, it's a compelling cover. It shows a chimpanzee in a suit, you know, sitting in a witness box. And so this HBO documentary just came out, and my wife caught it, and she's like, you got to watch this. And so, of course, we're checking this out. And there's tells in here that are fascinating. And I've got this clip of coming to an appeals court in New York State where the it's not a zoo, but it's a, I don't know what it is. It's a research laboratory or something like that, that has this chimp named Tommy. And remember, Kurt Kallenbeck, I've got him in the intro clips where he says names are for things.
Always,
and so, you know, Tommy has a name, he's a thing. And so, and listen to how the defendant, I guess. You got Stephen Weiss, who's bringing the case on behalf of the chimp. And then you have the opposition, which is, I take that back. I think this guy's a public, now what is he? Is he a state prosecutor or is he a private attorney? I can't remember. I think he's a private attorney. Anyway, just check this out.
And we believe that it is reasonably likely that the Court of Appeals will indeed take further review of the Lavery case.
Okay, thank you. We'll turn now to the issue of personhood. Mr. Colston.
Your Honor, there's simply no precedent anywhere of a non-human animal receiving the right kinds of rights they're talking about.
Now, that's the second time I heard that term in these two clips. Did you catch it?
The non-human animal?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not lost on me, but I think it's lost on most.
I agree. Well, most people would never take a look at the man or other animals code that the government operates from.
But apparently it's ubiquitous amongst the legal profession. They get it.
Oh, yeah.
The kinds of rights they're talking about. The exceptions that do exist to legal personhood being assigned to something that's not human, in every instance that they've cited, it's something that in some way relates to human interests, whether it's a corporation, whether a ship is treated as a legal person. We think that really is the principle that's governed the assignment of legal personhood. We think that's what the Lavery Court said. And we think that's the law, Your Honor, and we don't know of any exceptions otherwise, and petitioner hasn't cited any.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wise.
Your Honor, to say that no non-human animal has ever been the recipient of a writ of habeas corpus, well, you know, until the Non-Human Rights Project began filing these suits, no one had ever asked. And the entire hearing has to be looked at in the context of the extraordinary purpose of a writ of habeas corpus. It is the most important writ in the arsenal of writs that are in the Anglo-Saxon heritage. It's not called the Great Writ, capital G, capital W, for nothing. And the very purpose is to protect autonomous and self-determining beings. But science has shown us over the last 50 years, especially over the last 20, that there are more autonomous beings in this world than just human beings. Chimpanzees are not cabined by instinct. They're self-conscious. They have a theory of mind. They can understand what others are thinking. They understand that they're individuals, that their lives mean something to them, which is one of the reasons why imprisoning a chimpanzee is at least as bad and maybe even worse than imprisoning a human being. Because chimpanzees who are in prison and being essentially being exploited by Stony Brook now, that they don't even know why they're there. These are the sort of things that we would only do to our worst criminals amongst us. And one thing I want to make clear is that our argument is limited, extremely limited, to the argument that Hercules and Leo, these chimpanzees, should be persons solely for the purpose of a common law writ of habeas corpus.
Thank you. Understanding what Mr. Wise refers to.
He's just trying to establish standing to exercise the habeas corpus hearing. This is like a pre-trial thing.
Yeah, that it's fascinating to hear the argument.
It is. There's a couple more minutes. You want to hear the rest of it?
Sure.
Great writ and what it means to us. And I think another judge of this court many years ago referred to it as a powerful and broad tool subject to expansive interpretation and our understanding that the law evolves according to scientific discovery, social mores, witness marital rights. Isn't it incumbent upon the judiciary to at least consider whether a class of beings may be granted a right or something short of a right under the habeas statute? Some kind of special statute?
It's incredible to me. Granted a right, rather than does this entity or being or status have a right that needs protected, that we swore to protect? That's the dynamic. But I guess, like you said, Corey, they're in the federal plantation zone.
Yeah.
They're not even remotely about one of the people of the several states. So he's,
yeah, that's not come up. That whole thing has not come up at all.
Yeah. So I'm comparing apples and oranges. I get it. I just think that it's a fascinating dynamic here, and the tells that are there regarding granting rights versus protecting, I think, are instructive.
Thus, why can't a chimpanzee by virtue of the traits documented in petitioner's exhibits, the expert exhibits, be deemed a person for the sole purpose, as Mr. Wise says, of permitting the writ to the very limited extent sought. Why isn't that an appropriate use of this great writ?
Your Honor, what has been diminished all along in this proceeding is how different it is what they're actually trying to do. How these similarities that they paint, you can talk about 99% of DNA and other aspects that create similarities, but the reality is that these are fundamentally, they are different species. I worry about the diminishment of these rights in some way if we expand them beyond human beings. I also think courts are simply just not going to be equipped to determine where this new line is going to be for these vague categories that, yes, they've given them some...
Do you believe that an attorney was concerned about the diminishment of rights, Corey? I find that one hard to swallow.
Yeah, that's a little tough.
And I say that in all fairness to my friend, my friends who are attorneys. It's just amazing how elite that whole cast is regarding they're there to govern what your rights are and are not.
Scientific heft, but autonomy and self-determining, this just becomes a question of where are we going? You absolutely are opening the possible floodgates, and it is a great writ, but it's been a great writ for human beings. I think it should stay there, and I think the ramifications are ones that we can't always foresee and could have a dramatic effect, not only on our understanding of how important these rights are to human beings, but in applications that could affect our society in a negative way.
Thank you.
He doesn't define the negative way.
You're right, he doesn't.
It's just, because it's different, it's going to be negative. And I'm not advocating for this necessarily. It's a tough call when you see some of the clips of how inhumane these animals are being treated in these testing facilities. It tugs at you. It's not cool.
Well, of course. And I mean, my personal opinion is I like most animals more than I do most people. So I'm definitely in favor of treating animals very, very
humanely.
Humanely, of course. Yeah. And especially animals with such high levels of intelligence. But it is, I think it is a great way to display how low on the totem pole a U.S. citizen is, that a U.S. citizen is, on the same par in personhood as a chimpanzee, whereas an Article 4 citizen is completely different. I can't imagine any attorney arguing for the right of a chimpanzee to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment.
No, that's probably not going to happen. There's just a few, there's about a minute left on here.
Cool.
If you define a good hearing as one in which the judge asks a lot of questions and is clearly giving both sides a fair and comprehensive listen, I thought it went great.
What happens now?
I believe the judge is going to take it under advisement, and sometime in the next month or two, we should have a decision.
Stephen, quick question. How significant is the fact that this hearing today even took place, in your words?
It is highly significant because a writ of habeas corpus hearing for a non-human animal is being held in the same way it would be for a human being. So we're now being treated like all the other autonomous beings of this world.
So is this a partial victory?
It's a partial victory just standing here. Yes, yes.
You're right, Corey. It's shown how low the bar is for U.S. citizens.
Yeah, absolutely. I could absolutely see a court coming to a determination that a chimpanzee has the same access to the Bill of Rights as a U.S. citizen.
Which is discretionary and at the whim of the overlords.
Correct. Yeah, exactly.
Based on our, meaning the overlords, interpretation of social welfare, sustainability, economic justice, social justice, the mores of society, as that judge said, just totally pontificating.
Yeah,
on the subjective level, and you're right. I think you're right that the artificial intelligence movement, the non-human rights movement, it's going to flourish. It's going to continue to get codified and become its own little fiefdom of discretionary privileges and immunities, but that are going to be capricious and at the whim of those who have it's outside of a Republican form of government, and it could do whatever that system could do whatever it wants.
Yeah. And as far as AI rights, that's something that's already been addressed in Japan. In fact, I think you can check me on this, but I think that they have already established civil code in Japan regarding the rights of robots. And the theory was, if you have somebody who is maybe an elderly person and they're at home and they send their robot to the store to go buy food, that robot has the agency of the person who sent them and is carrying a certain set of rights. So in other words, they can't just be stopped. It can't just be picked up. It has to be treated.
Fascinating.
Yeah, almost as an extension of the person, which, kind of in a way makes sense, because if you've got somebody who is a shut-in at home and elderly, and they're dependent on this robot to go get them food and, supplies, stopping that robot just without any, without any protections at all would in fact, it would infringe on that person's right to life. So it's a really fascinating.
Hall pass! Show me your hall pass!
There you go. That's it. Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. The whole argument on AI is really interesting.
It does make you wonder what the robot's response would be to a cop if, here in Gitmo Nation, Iowa, where they can open up an investigation in their own head and not tell anybody and demand to see ID and or tell me your date of birth. Date of birth. See your date of birth. What do you got? So does a robot tell the cop its inception date when it got turned on, or does it tell it its master's or owner's date of birth? I mean, this is the stuff that's coming, and it is a huge distraction to what we are trying to aver, and that is the foundational protected rights that founded the so-called country we live in.
Well, I guarantee the first video of a robot responding to a cop saying, "What's your specific articulable suspicion of a crime?" is going to get 50 million views.
And you can't? Can you tase a robot? I don't know if that you're going to have a whole different the military industrial complex is loving this. We got to come up with all new weapons for robots now.
Yeah,
the sound cannon doesn't work on them.
Or seeing a bunch of thug cops beating on a robot yelling, "Stop resisting, stop resisting."
Oh, it's going to get weird, man.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
All right, quick update on the grand jury side. I reached out to the county attorney, did not reply. So I went down to the courthouse on Friday. Low risk, high reward activity, everybody. What's the latest low risk, high reward activity you took? All right. Have you taken any at all? I mean, this is a 15-minute exercise just to know who the grand jury is and is there a new one being convened? And you go to the clerk of the court's desk where it says jury information, and they had to call the clerk who wasn't in, and they explained to me that, oh, you know what? We are going to convene a new one for this year. It's happening March 7th. So I got a date. I'll be in attendance on March 7th at the convening of the grand jury. And it's important to do these things so the grand jurors see your face. Know that who you are. I tend to try and ask a question in each one, much to the chagrin of the court that thinks it's some hallowed star chamber where the citizens shall not speak. And at least you never know. But for the grace of God, you could be needing a grand jury indictment on some government overlord who has really crossed the line.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's fantastic. I've marked on my calendar for the impanelment of the grand jury here in Los Angeles. That comes up in, I think it's June, but it's in my calendar now. So
3,100 counties across America, 3,100 grand juries impaneled maybe every year. Each county probably has a different structure. At least, find out. There's low risk, high reward. How does the grand jury process work in your county? Now, keep in mind, we understand this is the grand jury that for all intents and purposes is being convened under the statutory federal district. We get
this. The federal plantation copy of the Republican form of government grand jury.
the nuance is that even a federal entity is taking an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution, and that is where the guarantee for Republican form of government exists. So it's our, I think, Corey, correct me if I'm wrong, assertion that if we can gain recognition as Article IV state citizens, even that entity is bound to protect our rights.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. That the whole purpose of the administrative government is to guarantee a Republican form of government to the several states. That's why it exists.
So get out there and check out your grand jury where you live. I mean, that's as simple as it gets. And of course, if they say, yes, we have one, and they say, you know, but we can't tell you who it is, the grand jury proceedings are secret, then you need to assert yourself even further, because that is inaccurate. The proceedings, when they do convene, are secret for good reasons. That way, false accusations do not impugn the integrity or the reputation of falsely accused. But as far as who they are, how are you supposed to bring a matter to a grand jury if you don't know who they are? And the government, the state, they will take the position that they're the gatekeeper of who shall bring a matter before a grand jury, but we assert otherwise. So find out who the grand jury manager is, make sure you have their contact information, and if you can be there when they're sworn in and get their attention, they'll know, they'll remember you. Because I would venture to say, Corey, that in most of the counties across America, when the grand jury is impaneled, very few regular Joes off the street are even present to even see it happen. Don't even know goes on.
I think you would you definitely would be noticed for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And a quick note on the rights for chimps, that documentary is Unlocking the Cage. And there were some segments that were in other court proceedings, which I was intrigued by the fact that these courts allowed such detailed camera work inside them, you know, obviously because it's such a unique case. And I guess it's because it was HBO. They got in. But you and I, Corey, want to bring our little iPhone in to record?
Forget about it.
But one of the things that was brought up numerous times was that with rights come duties and responsibilities. And of course, the duties and responsibilities were not articulated in the court when they brought those up, but they were stated that these entities, these chimps, need to be treated as 5-year-olds, according to Stephen Wise, who cannot have duties and responsibilities as children, but they still have rights that are, you know, granted, or they didn't say protected, but they still have rights to habeas corpus, to not be incarcerated. So, you know, on that nuance, yeah, a 5-year-old doesn't, you know, can't be incarcerated, I guess, involuntary servitude. But I was fascinated that rights came with duties and responsibilities was even brought up.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I think it is definitely, it just really highlights the secondary status of U.S. citizenship, the way that that's being argued.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So let's go to, here's a fun one, just a little sidebar for you. You may have heard this already. And I'm going to let Lou Dobbs introduce it. He does it better than I do.
Admission by a member of the national left-wing media. Listen to MSNBC's Mika Brzezinski this morning talking about the media's role.
He's trying to undermine the media, trying to make up his own facts. And it could be that while unemployment and the economy worsens, he could have undermined the messaging so much that he can actually control exactly what people think. And that is our job.
And I went back. Have you heard this?
I have. Yeah, that was a pretty that kind of lit the internet on fire for a little while.
It's a big tell. And my wife Kathleen and I were watching this, and we went and found the full clip because there was a single clip that everybody repeated over and over on YouTube. You know, various different people. I went and found the extended version, if you will, of the rest of the exchange with the people, you know, on the screen. And there was not any more context that addressed that. They moved on to different, you know, approach, a different trajectory, if you will. And so there was, it's not taken out of context. It was laid on the table and left on the table.
Right. I think it was a kind of inadvertent use of words.
Kind of just really?
Well, I mean, I don't think that either one of those hosts. It's Morning Joe, I think, is
that's correct. Yep.
Yeah,
Morning Joe Scarborough.
Joe. Right. So I don't think that that they would want to just plainly lay out there that, hey, we don't want the president being able to contact the people directly. We want to filter. We want the president's, you know, words and all of that to be filtered through us, the press.
That's our job.
That's our job, right? I think that kind of no matter who you are, that doesn't play very well. That the press would be, you know, that they would rather it have the belief that, hey, we're the press, we're going to get you the truth, not control what you think.
So when you say you don't think that was inadvertent, or you do think it was inadvertent?
I think the honesty of it was inadvertent.
Okay, in Black's Law, inadvertence, an accidental oversight, a result of carelessness.
Yeah, in other words, being careless about saying, hey, we're going to control what you think.
You think she was just being careless, but you think she believes it?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, we're in agreement then. Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Oh, yeah. And, you know, this is not new information to the listeners of Agenda 31. You know, this type of mindset, and it's just a reinforcement of what we already know, and that's why you listen to podcasts like Agenda 31, and perhaps you're listening to us on the playback on the No Agenda Stream at noagendastream.com, where you can listen to us right after Adam Curry and John C. Dvorak's deconstruction of the deep state called No Agenda. If you've not checked out No Agenda, you owe it to yourself to give it a try. Highly entertaining, highly informative. And we're lucky to be played back on the No Agenda Stream at around 2 o'clock Central after their 11 a.m. Central live broadcast, which is getting underway as we speak, Corey. So you have some clips that I'm going to play, Corey. Let's jump over to the stuff you sent me.
All right.
And let's talk about the first one, the non-FAA stuff, the other one, the...
So there we have got this thing that Governor Toilet Brown, basically what he did was came up with this whole idea of, oh, we got too many people in jail and we're going to fix it by the state, which is the one making all these laws that are putting people in jail. Instead of the state handling offenders, we're going to put all of that on local municipalities, including the cost. It was a great way for the governor to make it look like the state has a whole bunch more money that they can spend on other social programs, because now these costs are no longer being borne by the state. And there was a police officer killed this past week in Whittier. And, you know, I mean, it's really tragic. The officer from all the reports, he was well liked in the community. You know, I'm sure that the officer and I would have, you know, a huge battle going on when it comes to Article 4 citizenship, but that we both would be aligned in that, you know, there are some really bad people out there, and the person that killed this officer, all you have to do is look at him and you can see this is a really bad guy. And you hear the story about what he did just prior to murdering the officer, and you realize this is a really bad guy. So these are instances where I'm really grateful that the police are out there, because they're the ones showing up and they never know when they're going to have to deal with something like this. I know sometimes it gets overplayed a little bit, but credit where credit's due. This officer lost his life showing up to what appeared to be, you know, a relatively minor traffic accident. And the police chief, Jeff Piper, he said, I could only find a little clip of it. None of the news organizations, I heard it live, and I looked all over to try and get the entire thing, but every single news organization clipped this whole portion of it out. What I found was just a little bit. He went on a tirade and told the voters of California that you have some responsibility for this because the voters approved this whole realignment. That's what it's called, is realignment, where they're taking people out of the prisons and putting them into local jails. And then there isn't the same oversight. It's just not the same. Crime rates have gone up. LAPD has even said crime rates have gone up. You can look at the crime maps in this area, and all these, I call them libtards, these libtard individuals who have promoted this. One in particular is a woman who helped author this legislation. The idea is if we just change the definition of a crime, then there is no increase in crime. And that's really what they've done. So you have some of these people who get out of jail that are, you know, clearly there's a real problem here. In my opinion, this guy should have never been out of jail looking at his record. But play the clip from the police chief, Jeff Piper, first.
Enough is enough. You're passing these propositions, you're creating these laws that is raising crime, and it's not good for our communities, and it's not good for our officers.
So that was the most, that's all I could find. And I heard that live on the radio when he gave that conference, that press conference. And he went on and was very articulate about how the voters have a culpable responsibility to this officer's death by passing that. And then there's this other clip. It's about 8 minutes long, so you can cut it off anytime you want. But John and Ken, they're on the biggest AM radio station in Los Angeles. It's a 50,000 watt station. It's heard all over the place. They're just a major, major broadcast station here in Los Angeles. And they have this thing I absolutely love. It was inspired by, I think, some Polish people, some people in the Ukraine, where they literally will throw politicians in a dumpster. If they get mad at them, they'll throw them in a dumpster. Well, for this particular one, it's John and Ken throwing a bunch of politicians in Satan's lake of fire. And I think they do a good job of deconstructing this. So check it out.
Before we play this, I want to ask a clarifying question with regards to the murder of that cop.
Yeah.
The guy who killed him, he was let out of prison as part of a realignment law that redefined certain crimes to allow for shorter sentences.
That's correct. So, okay. What it has to be in order to get out of prison, it has to be a nonviolent crime. And I mean, and they go based on your most recent crime. So if you've been a violent felon, you've raped, murdered, I mean, you've done all kinds of stuff, maybe not quite murder. I don't know if he had murder in his rap sheet or not, but he was convicted of several violent crimes. But what this whole new realignment thing does is it says, well, if your most recent crime was not violent, then you can get out early.
Got it.
So he was back in jail after being convicted of violent crimes and let out, was back in jail for auto theft. He'd been arrested multiple times. And, you know, I mean, they let him out because they've redefined auto theft as a non, or not redefined, but they define auto theft as a nonviolent crime. So you can steal a car and, you know, and get out.
Got it. All right, let's listen to John and Ken.
It's time for John and Ken to throw a hack in a dumpster.
John and Ken Show, John Cobell and Ken Shampoo, KFI, AM 640. It's not just a hack in a dumpster day. It's a special edition. We're throwing someone into Satan's lake of fire.
Donald Trump! Donald Trump!
And not just someone, a whole lot of someones.
We have the Serbs, we got the Ukrainians, and we got the Poles here. And they got a lot of heavy lifting to do.
Clearly, it's been a very tough week all throughout California. People learned of the death of Whittier Police Officer Keith Boyer. A story that started for Officer Boyer and his partner when they were called to the scene of a traffic accident in Whittier. That's what they thought they were called upon to respond to. But when they got there, they found out that instead it was a heavily tattooed gang member who decided he's not going to be taken alive, and he opened fire. They did shoot and wound the gang member, but Officer Boyer was killed because obviously he got the jump on them.
He's the fourth police officer killed by somebody who should have been in prison on a parole violation. The fourth one in the last few months, just in Southern California.
Now, Satan's Lake of Fire, of course, would have to deal with the perpetrators behind the legislation that enabled this thug killer gang member to be on the streets of Whittier last Monday morning. His name is Michael Mejia, and it turns out that he had quite a day. He went and shot his cousin to death, stole his cousin's car, ends up in Whittier, rear ends another motorist's car. They stop for the accident, and that's where Officer Boyer comes into the story, sadly, and Mejia kills him. Assembly Bill 109 is the reason for this. We wondered when this happened if that wasn't possible. We all know about what Prop 47 is doing, what Prop 57 is going to do. But the oldest of these is Assembly Bill 109, passed back in 2011. The brainchild of Jerry Brown. In fact, from what we understand, the whole thing started with Jerry Brown, foisted it on the legislature. Here's a twist to the story. It was a budget bill. Yes, it was done through the budget committee process because it was going to save money on incarceration costs. So obsessed with the rising costs of our prisons, and John and I pointed out many, 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 many times that why not just fix the rising cost rather than just release prisoners?
It costs 2 to 3 times more per prisoner here than in many other states. 2 to 3 times as much.
In Iowa, Corey, it's about $35,000 a year to house a prisoner.
I think it's about $85,000 a year here in California.
Because of court orders that the prisons were overcrowded, that the medical services and mental health services were not up to par, Jerry Brown got obsessed with this, and he decided in 2011, let's come up with a bill to make sure these guys are not returning to the state prisons. So, yes, we know LA Times, it was not an early release bill. But what it did instead was set up the circumstances for Michael Mejia to be on the streets of Whittier last Monday.
What they did is they did away with state parole for many prisoners. So that when Michael Mejia was finally let out of prison for the second time, he wasn't going to go back to state prison for a parole violation. That was the old policy.
The counties would be in charge, and this is always overlooked, but important to point out. You had to be labeled a nonviolent, non-serious offender. And he got that designation, despite the fact that he was involved in an armed robbery.
His second and last convicted crime was auto theft. So he was declared nonviolent. So he was subject to different rules. And instead of being thrown back into prison for a year, because that was the old law, you could go back to prison for up to a year. After five arrests following his last incarceration, he was only given 10 days or less after some of these arrests.
So it could have been a year in state prison turned into days, which enabled him to bounce around. You think about this, too, in another universe. Maybe if he'd been thrown in prison for up to a year, I don't know if it would have changed him, but would have had a chance to keep him away from all the other violations he committed, and, of course, from being in Whittier on Monday. Well,
this other universe is just pervasive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's right. He should have been thrown in prison, certainly after the fifth violation, right? The fifth arrest? One of those arrests was for methamphetamine. That, under the old system, would have gotten you back in prison for a year. He would not have been free, but he was, and he killed Officer Keith Boyer. That's why Jerry Brown is responsible. Now, we've explained this in great detail here. In the Los Angeles Times, they don't mention this at all.
No, and they keep harping what the state corrections department gave them. This was not an early release.
This is why.
Nobody said it was.
And you wonder why the Trump administration kicked.
If it's not an early release, what is it?
Well, so it's playing with the definition of words. They're saying it's not an early release because he served all of his time for the nonviolent crime of stealing a car. But it doesn't take into consideration the massive rap sheet that this guy has.
Los Angeles Times out of a press briefing today, because this is the dishonesty of the Los Angeles Times. In fact, what they did yesterday, they ran an editorial criticizing the police chief of Whittier.
Yeah, Jeff Piper.
Jeff Piper, because he blamed AB 109 for what happened. And Piper is correct.
They just called him, like, emotionally overwrought.
The Los Angeles Times is dishonest, and what they wrote about Piper yesterday was just flat-out cruel.
So what we're going to do is throw in Jerry Brown and all the legislators that co-sponsored Assembly Bill 109 from 2011. We have the list.
We're going to name them all here. Well, first of all, we've got to fish Jerry Brown's bones out of the lake of fire.
Well, let's get in there. Svetlana, bring the mobs.
Send some Serbs and Ukrainians in there. Yes, we're ready. You got to pull his bones out, all right?
All right, we begin by throwing in Jerry Brown, the governor.
Look, he's just a skeleton head. Some decaying flesh.
And now, one by one and quickly, here come all the legislators involved in this horrendous piece of legislation.
Bob Blumenfield. Into the lake.
From Woodland Hills. He's now in the L.A. City Council.
Luis Alejo from Watsonville.
By the way, they're all Democrats.
Michael Allen of Santa Rosa.
Julia Brownlee from Santa Monica.
Joan Buchanan from Alamo. Yes, you deathmongers.
Betsy Butler, Marina Del Rey.
One of our favorites, Gil Sinise. When bad folks go, they die. Don't go to heaven where the angels fly.
Well, I dare say, Corey, that the people that they threw in the lake had good intentions.
That's exactly what they do. Is as long as you have good intentions, reality doesn't matter. These people are completely out of touch. California is run by a cabal of Democrats that are... they're insane. They're literally insane. It wasn't that long ago that you have one guy who ended up being arrested by the FBI, I think he was a senator, who was pushing for crazy gun legislation. At the same time, he was running guns or attempting to run guns from the Philippines to gang members in the San Francisco area. The mentality of these people are just nuts. California is out of control.
Yes.
And for the LA Times to say that the police chief, you know, it was pretty emotional. Whittier is a fairly quiet town, relatively quiet. I mean, the last time an officer was killed was, I think, 40 years ago. And the police chief had known this officer who died, known him for 25 years. He had recently been kind of planning for his retirement. And so the police chief was, you know, emotional, but he's frustrated like a lot of police are in California with this AB 109, where, you know, it's just a way of making the paperwork look like, oh, there's no crime. Let him out. There's no crime.
As those guys said, rather than address the high cost of incarceration, what's going on there? You know, this is just like the quick fix to relieve some pressure on cost. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. You gave me a great opportunity to play the Meat Puppets clip I've always wanted to play. So thank you for that.
I like it.
Let's,
so anyway, that was something I thought was really interesting. As far as the media even going after a police chief, I mean, they cut out and selectively edited his, his press conference, every single one of them. Most of them just kind of ignored the police chief kind of calling out the voters on, hey, the voters hold some responsibility for this. But it was just so disgusting to me about how the media, especially the LA Times, saying that he was emotionally distraught and didn't really mean what he said, you know, that there is no additional crime with AB 109. It's just fantasy world craziness.
Well, on back on the front of low risk, high reward activity, Corey, you recently engaged the Federal Aviation Authority. Is that the proper?
Yes, Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, if anybody has seen some of my videos, I've posted a couple of videos. I have a drone, and drones for U.S. citizens are subject to mandatory registration with the FAA. And the FAA, well, first off, I've got some hours. I used to have a family interest in a Beechcraft Bonanza. I've done, you know, several hundred hours of flying solo in and around Southern California. I understand airspace, and drones are have the potential to be incredibly dangerous, especially in an area like, you know, Southern California, where there's a huge amount of air traffic here. And these are big jets that are flying over. You know, just right near me, we've got Van Nuys Airport, we've got Burbank, and also Los Angeles International Airport, where big jets come in, and a drone could potentially take down one of those jets. So it's really important to be safe, incredibly important to be able to coordinate the use of airspace with the FAA. So what the FAA has now is you have to register your drone. If you don't register it, you're subject to a $10,000 penalty. And there's people that are getting hit with penalties for it. But the website's very clear on who has to, you know, register a drone. I think, fortunately, instead of me reading through all of this, we had Jennifer help out. The FAA has some definitions that are a little bit dry, but I think this is important. Play clip one.
Definition. Of small unmanned aircraft, SUA, means an unmanned aircraft weighing less than 55 pounds on takeoff, including everything that is on board or attached to the aircraft. United States citizen means an individual who is a citizen of the United States or one of its possessions. A partnership of which each individual is a citizen of the United States. A corporation or association created or organized under the laws of the United States or a state, territory, or possession thereof, of which the president and 2/3 or more of the board of directors and other managing officers are individual U.S. citizens, and at least 75% of the voting interest is owned or controlled by persons who are U.S. citizens.
Let's hear that last part again, please. Actually, the whole thing again. One more time.
Definition. Of small unmanned aircraft, SUA, means an unmanned aircraft weighing less than 55 pounds on takeoff, including everything that is on board or attached to the aircraft. United States citizen means an individual who is a citizen of the United States or one of its possessions. A partner...
Possessions.
Yeah.
Do we consider one of the several states to be a possession of the United States?
No, no. A possession would be something like Puerto Rico, Guam, you know, things like that.
Yep.
Of which each individual is a citizen of the United States. A corporation or association created or organized under the laws of the United States or a state, territory, or possession thereof.
So a corporation can be a U.S. citizen?
Yes.
Of which the president and 2/3 or more of the board of directors and other managing officers are individual U.S. citizens, and at least 75% of the voting interest is owned or controlled by persons who are U.S. citizens.
All right.
So that's important as far as looking at the complexity of aircraft. You know, some aircraft are very, very expensive. There are drones. We're talking about drones. My drone is not, you know, of that class. But there are some drones now that do incredible scanning, inspections.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's
people that have whole businesses doing inventory management at construction sites and scanning of everything from heat, thermal registration to, you know, density of rock. I mean, it's crazy.
Absolutely. Last week, I attended a seminar online for doing photo Well, basically, it's your drone goes up, it flies a mission, it takes hundreds or even thousands of pictures of an area, and then the computer stitches all of those pictures together and renders a 3D model. And that's for, you know, volume. If you've got a mining site where you need to know how much, you know, aggregate you've got stacked in one area, make sure that the mine boss can do it. They're really just amazing, amazing devices. Mm-hmm. And so that's something, a quick plug. My website is pacificaerialvideo.com. And, you know, I love flying, and this is a little hobby that, you know, hopefully the services that it provide would be able to pay for it. And maybe, you know, make a little bit of coin. But getting back to the FAA, the, you know, those definitions were a little bit complicated, because what happens is you get people who will, you know, maybe get three or four people who go in together on a drone that might cost $100,000 to do some sort of surveillance or inspections or, you know, whatever it is that you're working on. And so people set up complicated ownership structures. And so the FAA has some real serious definitions there. Well, my drone is very simple, and it fits that first definition.
Less than 55 pounds.
Less than 55 pounds with everything on board. You know, it's certainly less than 55 pounds. It's more than half a pound. So it fits that first definition. But in clip two, we talk about the aircraft registration requirements. And Jennifer reads this part. This is all taken from the CFR, commercial flight rules for the FAA. This is like the vehicle code for airplane or aircraft. And play clip two.
Traditional aircraft registration under 14 CFR Part 47 is required for unmanned aircraft that weigh 55 pounds or more, for SUA owned by a trustee under a trust agreement, and when the SUA owner uses a voting trust to meet U.S. citizenship requirements.
One more time.
Traditional aircraft registration under 14 CFR Part 47 is required for unmanned aircraft that weigh 55 pounds or more, for SUA owned by a trustee under a trust agreement, and when the SUA owner uses a voting trust to meet U.S. citizenship requirements.
Okay.
So the ownership of aircraft can fall under a lot of different things. And in this particular sense, the drone does not fit this particular definition for what is called an N number through the mail.
A what?
Now we go in an N number. So if you ever
N
see
as in
an
Nancy?
Airplane, what's that?
N as in Nancy?
Correct.
Okay.
N as in November.
Okay.
The N number on an airplane is like the license plate number for an airplane. They all start with an N.
Okay.
And if you have a drone that you don't fit the online registration requirements, then they make arrangements for, like, if you have a drone that weighs more than 55 pounds, for example, there's now drones that are doing crop spraying and they'll weigh quite a bit more than 55 pounds. Those don't fit. Or if it's owned by somebody who's not a U.S. citizen and they've set up a voting trust as far as how to operate the vehicle, and they're doing that purely to gain the benefit of having U.S. citizenship to operate their aircraft here, then that would apply. Well, my drone doesn't apply there. Now let's look at 14 CFR registration information for aircraft eligibility. And this is the part that has required that I contact the FAA for safety reasons. So go ahead and play clip three.
Definition. Of small unmanned aircraft.
Oh, wait, I apologize. Here it is.
That's right clip
here.
One.
Yeah, here we go.
14 CFR Part 47 SUA and UA registration information. Eligibility. An aircraft is eligible for United States registration only if it is owned by a citizen of the United States, an individual citizen of a foreign country lawfully admitted for permanent residence, a corporation, not a U.S. citizen, lawfully organized under the laws of the United States or any state thereof, as long as the aircraft is based and primarily used in the U.S., or a governmental unit of the United States, and the aircraft is not registered under the laws of any foreign county.
Hmm.
So the key on that is owned by a United States citizen, Right. So that's where I brought my letter, which is being sent to a FISDO. FISDO is the Flight Inspection Services District Office of the FAA. And they're at most major airports. The closest one here is the one at Van Nuys. And I believe it's Flight Inspection Service District Office is what it's called. And first off with the FAA, all my time flying, I did quite a bit of flying out to Vegas. I've flown to Reno quite a few times, flown mainly out of Corona, Chino, Ontario area. Never once did I ever have a ramp check with the FAA. And every time I went to a seminar, one thing I can say is that every FAA employee or inspector that I've ever come in contact with, their number one priority was safety. That's the thing that I've looked at with every FAA inspector. So I'm hoping that that continues. I had a conversation with the FISDO officer who's in charge of the drone program for Van Nuys. His name is Paul Penner. And I explained to him that, you know, the way the FAA has the website set up and that a aircraft is only eligible for registration if it's owned by a U.S. citizen, then that excludes citizens of the several states.
You told him this on the phone.
I did, yeah. Mm. And, you know, his number one concern was, look, you know, I'd sure hate to see something happen where, you know, you get dinged for not registering your aircraft when you're supposed to register it.
Never mind that registration of the unmanned. What's the acronym?
SUAS. That stands for Small Unmanned Aircraft System.
Okay. SUAS. SUAS. So never mind that this registration has nothing to do with your ability to govern this thing safely.
It doesn't. But what it does, once you've registered, and you can go on YouTube and find out about this. Once you've registered a drone aircraft, it makes it very easy for the FAA to issue a citation for any of the administrative agencies of the federal government to issue expensive citations that they can now just give you a ticket, much like you would for a car. And that's something I have never heard of before. I'm not aware of in general aviation, if you're flying an airplane that you sit in, that the FAA can just give you a ticket and you have to pay a fine and, you know, and that's it. Well, the registration process is what enables that. And if you're subject to registration and you don't register your aircraft, then you can be subject to a $10,000 fine. It's huge. And I get it. I get that the FAA, if you talk to any, you go to the seminars, you go to some of the training seminars. I've been to a couple of them now, some online, but I went to one at Whitehead Airport here a few weeks ago, and there was a FISDO officer who was there, and their major concern, they'll straight up tell you that, you know, we got to figure out how to deal with this because there are literally millions of drones that now have incredible capability. My drone can fly a couple of miles, no problem, and could easily reach heights that would interfere with aircraft. And I'm very well aware and can read a sectional chart. We can put a link into on the website if we want for the SLA sectional. It requires training to be able to read a sectional chart for aircraft. And there are highways in the air that you know, aircraft take that to keep everybody deconflicted, you know, so you don't have airplanes just running into each other. Basically, with drones, you're not allowed to fly over 400 feet above ground level. You have to stay 5 miles away from any airport. If you're going to operate a drone within 5 miles of an airport, you need to contact the airport and get the air traffic control tower and, you know, get...
This is if you're registered.
This is if you're registered. Well, I mean, in my opinion, if you're not subject to registration, then you still need to contact the airport to let them know you're going to be operating a drone so they can tell all the pilots in the area that, hey, there's a drone operating in this area from this time to this time. It's super easy to do. It's no problem. But you cannot get flight services from the FAA unless your drone is registered.
And by flight services, you mean what?
Well, that means you call up and tell them, let's say I'm going to
You can't notify them that you're going to be within 5 miles unless you're registered.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, they won't even take your notification. They won't,
got it.
They won't talk to you. So
even if you want to be safe and comply with the rules as a non-registered drone, they won't even deal with you.
Correct.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. And that's my experience so far. Mm-hmm. So what I'm writing to the FAA is, hey, there's, you know, basically my letter, which we can put on the website, is real simple. I'm just asking for guidance on how do you deconflict airspace with a drone that's not subject to registration, but could be flying within 5 miles of an airport. It's important for small aircraft. If you're flying a little Cessna 152, and you know, those things are mopeds of the sky. They got paper thin aluminum skins. If there's a drone flying in an area, you want to know about it. And it's so simple to just call the tower and tell them, hey, I'm going to be flying in this area. It's 4 miles from the airport. 99% of the time, it's never going to affect any aircraft. But at least they know about it. And if they see a small airplane heading in the area of where you're going to operate a drone, then the flight following service that the FAA provides, which is if you're in an airplane, you tell them you're going from point A to point B and you request flight following, they'll just give you updates. Like if you're going into a military operating area that's hot, they'll say, hey, you can't go there. If you're going into an area where there's a drone, they'll say, look, there's a drone operating in that area, just so the pilot can be aware. And if the drone stays below 400 feet and the pilot stays above 1,000 feet, then everything's fine. But, if you completely exclude an entire section of the population, because remember, citizens of the several states are presumed to exist, and you know they're allowed to own a drone. There's nothing that says they can't own a drone.
Here you go again, Corey, trying to aver Article 4 state citizenship through some other low-risk, high-reward activity. The letter is dated February 25th. It's to the FISDO office in Van Nuys. It says, guidance on deconflicting airspace requested. Dear Mr. Penner, thank you for your time the other day on the telephone. Per our conversation, please forward this letter to appropriate FAA department for response. I am a citizen of California pursuant to Article 4, Section 2, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution. See enclosed citizenship affidavit. I intend to fly a SUAS within the borders of California as stated in the 1849 California Constitution, primarily within the area covered by the SLA sectional chart. I am not a United States citizen pursuant to the 14th Amendment, and U.S. citizenship is a mandatory requirement to qualify for to qualify a SUAS for registration with the FAA. Therefore, my SUAS does not qualify for registration with the FAA. If a provision for non-U.S. citizens, non-resident aliens, to obtain acknowledgement of ownership of a SUAS from the FAA is available, please forward that information to my mailing address listed above. The purpose of this letter is to obtain guidance on coordinating future flights of SUAS not qualified for FAA registration or issuance of an N number with local air traffic control. As aeronautical safety is a primary concern, guidance from the FAA to safely coordinate use of airspace within the borders of California, as stated above, is requested. Thank you. So you sent it with a 3-cent stamp and did a little postscript at the end, too.
Yeah, a little postscript to send it with a 3-cent stamp. The
excellent.
Paul Penner said, man, you sound like you know what you're talking about, but I have no clue, and this is obviously way above my pay grade. So if you put your question in writing, then the FAA is obligated to respond. And so I'm really looking forward to, because the FAA is not geared towards revenue generation. That's not what they do. They're not an agency that is funded like you see local police, where they're just trying to get you on every single little citation and trying to get that ticket and get that fine. That's not the mentality of the FAA that I'm aware of. I could see it quickly going that way now that drones are being issued citations. But I really do think that the general consensus in the FAA is safety. That's really what they're shooting for, is keeping general aviation and commercial aviation safe. And I think their attorneys might have to look into this. And what a fascinating way to get at least one small win regarding Article 4 citizenship. So we'll see how this goes.
I think it's good. Let's face it, this is long overdue.
low risk, high reward, everybody. Corey, I think that's outstanding. And I wanted to bring up a, maybe it's on this over here. We will put that letter up at the show notes. I'm a little bit remiss on the show notes, per usual. We're trying my best, but it's not good enough.
It's fantastic, Todd. I think really. For what we got, we do a great job.
I appreciate Jesse Anderson, friend of the show, sending me some cover art. I'm going to use it for this episode 121. I'll get that up later this afternoon.
Awesome.
It's unique. It's different than anything we've done before.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's cool.
Who was it that sent it?
Jesse Anderson.
Yeah, where's Jesse from?
He's here in Scott County. He's
oh awesome.
He's,
okay,
he's a article. He knows what he's talking about. He's paying close attention to a lot of things and excellent friend and supporter. So another friend and supporter, a mutual friend. I think you remember Clyde Cleveland.
Yes.
Clyde authored the book Common Sense Revisited, the pamphlet that was the origin of our show together back on Republic Broadcasting Network. Remember
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Clyde yeah. popped in my office the other day. He was on his way to O'Hare Airport to fly to Acapulco.
Nice.
And he was going down to the Anarchapulco, evacuate the state, brave the future, the world's first and largest anarcho-capitalist conference. It's happening right now as we speak, Corey, down in Acapulco. He's a speaker down there. Did you hear about this?
I did not, no.
Yeah, check out, it's Anarchapulco, Anarchapulco, Anarchapulco.com. And this is founded by, let's see, let me go to the speakers here. A lot of them people have heard of. I think this guy's name is Jeffrey, I heard of it as an interview with Greg Carlwood, on the Jeff Berwick. Chief Freedom Officer, the Dollar Vigilante is his handle. He has a podcast he's been doing for a long time, a video cast. He organized this event talking about business and investment, health and wellness, lifestyle and relationships, media and politics and philosophy. And they include, the speakers include Jeff himself, G. Edward Griffin, Foster Gamble, creator of Thrive movie, Adam Kokesh. There's Adam, imagine that. Jeffrey Tucker.
Lauren Southern.
Yeah, Larkin Rose. Have you heard of some of these folks? Luke Radowski. Yeah, you know, excellent filmmaker. So the list is pretty cool. And I gave Clyde a bunch of Agenda 31 business cards and asked him to hit some people in the mouth down there. And Clyde is speaking as well. He's going to speak on the benefits of working in small self-determinant groups as founded by the group Gore-Tex. You familiar with Gore-Tex, the fabric?
Yeah, yeah.
The guy that started that apparently was innovative in what Clyde has coined as octologs, working in groups of eight as self-autonomous people.
Okay.
And how that group, that company Gore-Tex, has no hierarchies. Nobody tells anybody what to do, yet they're this massive, huge, successful company that creates lots of value for their customers.
Yeah.
So that's what Clyde's speaking about. Anyway, I said, you know, he said, who else do you want me to give this card to down there? I wrote to him, whoever you think is capable of getting outside of their box regarding the so-called benefits of U.S. citizenship and understanding the power of a guaranteed Republican form of government in the several states, which is only enforceable by Article 4 state citizens, then please share it with them. If Foster Gamble and G. Edward can handle it, please share. So we'll see if Clyde gets it on the table with those guys.
Well, certainly Foster Gamble with Thrive Movie. I mean, I think if they could just understand that difference between U.S. citizenship and Article 4 citizenship, it would be that giant leap forward that he talks about in the Thrive Movie.
Yeah, all these people are rowing in the same direction. In terms of, you know, individualism and self-determination. But I would venture to say very few have what is a proposed solution. You know, I didn't catch Adam Kokesh's solution when we interviewed him. Education was his solution. Educate more people to be non-coercive. Okay? Yeah?
It's certainly not a solution to a winning legal argument.
Right.
Right. That's the problem. And, you know, even Adams dealt with You know, well, he was arrested in Washington, D.C. He was dealing with the code enforcement for his property out in Arizona. And, you know, he's hovering around a lot of stuff. But there's also the problem of, or the question, you know, he gets his paycheck from the government. And the conditions of that paycheck are you have to be a government employee. At least the theory is right now. Is it possible to maintain your benefits that, you know, some like Adam gets and then have no connection to the federal government? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, A for effort down in Acapulco at the Anarchapulco event. I think it's pretty cool.
I follow Lauren on Twitter. Have you ever seen Lauren? Have you ever seen
Lauren
her
Southern
do her
Rebel
interviews?
Media?
She is brilliant. I mean, she's obviously a very attractive woman. She is on a kind of a group called Rebel Media, and I believe she's Canadian. Mm-hmm. But her ability to think on her feet and to engage with people and just use facts and common sense and a quality argument is second to none. She's fantastic. So I just saw her on Twitter. She was talking about being in Acapulco, and I thought that was kind of strange. Well, now I understand why she's there.
Oh, that's cool. Maybe we'll play a clip of hers.
There's plenty of great stuff with her there.
Excellent.
And a lot of these people, what's fascinating is she is, in fact, in one case where all these people who are claiming to be peaceful, you know, all these anti-fascists, she has had stuff thrown at her, been called hate speech, all kinds of just crazy things for just using regular, basically disagreeing with some of the libtard left that she has interviewed. And they've attacked her. You know, she's been hit, and she's, you know, a very feminine woman, and all of these people who are saying that, you know, we're here to protect women, everything will attack her. It's just amazing how she's able to use her femininity in a very powerful way, which is what I would say is a real feminist.
You know, that brings up, I can't remember if I read this or not in the last episode. I think I brought up the fact that somebody went to a town hall meeting and was really concerned about how like overly aggressive the pro teachers union people were being, like,
yeah,
nearly violent, you know?
And
I remember when the Tea Party, you know, rose, you know, when Obama got elected, and I went to several town hall meetings, and it didn't get violent by any stretch. It certainly got, heated. I remember asking, what's his name? Oh God, I'm terrible with names these days. The guy who ran for, president. I'll think of a minute. He was a longtime senator and congressman and an attorney. And I asked him if he could tell the people what the, rights that were, enumerated in the First Amendment to be protected were. And everybody said, don't be so hard on them. I mean, that's the kind of activity I was involved in these so-called town hall meetings, you know? So,
right.
We didn't get violent in my view. So, and the other thing I wanted to bring up real quickly before we take off is, I've been noticing a lot of this, discussion of immigration and the sagas of people getting, you know, torn from their homes and deported and so forth. And because they're aliens, if you will, or undocumented or illegal, whatever. And it dawned on me the other day, Corey, we, you know, as Article 4 state citizens, we claim to be alien to the District of Columbia.
Correct.
Right? So yeah. If, you know, where physically would an ICE agent take you or I as Article 4 state citizens if we were to be deported out of the United States?
Well, there's a case that it's Frank Bruschaber versus the United States, and this is a fantastic taxing case. Frank Bruschaber was a citizen of New Jersey, I think it was, is how he worded it. And this was a guy who basically said, look, you can't tax me because I invested in a railroad. And the government came back and said, oh, yeah, we can. But the Department of Internal Revenue had to create a new classification for a state citizen, and that classification was non-resident alien. So, you know, as a state citizen, you're a non-resident, right?
Right.
Because you're domiciled in your state, so you're a non-resident. And with respect to the District of Columbia, if you have no connection to the federal government, then you're an alien. So the ICE agents would have nothing to do. It would be a violation for them to arrest you based on immigration standards.
Okay. And in terms of a exercise in geography, I was just trying to understand, like, well, these people who are getting deported, they don't have a driver's license. Maybe they do. The way things are happening in California, maybe they can get a DL. I don't know.
Right.
But if they were U.S. citizens, if they had been granted U.S. citizenship status, then they couldn't be deported, correct?
Correct, yeah.
All right, so they're not U.S. citizens. So if we're of the same class of somebody who's getting deported that I just spoke about, because we're not U.S. citizens, and I'm being facetious, you know, where would they take us? They couldn't take us anywhere because we're one of the people of several states. We're exactly where we're supposed to be.
And those aliens are considered resident aliens.
Okay. Interesting. Right? So that's interesting.
Not, yeah, they're not domiciled in one of the several states.
Ah.
They're resident in one of the several states.
Okay. Now,
and they are aliens. So they're resident aliens.
All right. I gotcha.
Oh, now I really see what's going on here.
Thank you, everybody, for your support of Agenda 31. We will read off our names of our supporters next episode as we do a little more show prep. And I've got to get scooting down the road here for another appointment I got to go to. But, you know, those that do support, Corey, I take it you have gotten some donations lately?
Yes, we do. And we'll have a nice list for next week. And thank you very much for the support. And next week we'll have an update on the Supreme Court challenge.
Yes, that's outstanding. You can go to agenda31.org. In the upper corner, you can subscribe. It's a complimentary subscription to have access to the blog. As a user of the blog, you'll get notifications via email of upcoming podcasts and any developments. You can also access the common law ID information and special video cast that Corey has put together based on his averment of Article 4 state citizenship, trying to get that in the Supreme Court. Otherwise, we encourage you to donate some shekels, if you will. Every little bit goes a long way, and there's multiple levels there for you to support, everything from $3.31 a month all the way up to $310 a year. And you can join the Agenda 31 tribe there at agenda31.org. We challenge everybody to continue asking yourself, what is your strategy to make a difference? Thank you for tuning in to the Lowest Risk, Highest Reward podcast in the universe.
Okay, guys, let's get out there and make a difference.
You know what to do.
First, I need to make sure Nicole is safe, so I need you to protect her.
Right, so go ask your government.
I can't.
Why not?
Because someone in the government's working with the terrorists.
People, we don't want them running our lives. We don't want them starting wars. We don't want them being able to assassinate people. This should just add to our impetus to try to do what we can to expose these people and to take power away from them so that they're not able to perform the evils that they have performed for so very long.
You have to understand, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. And many of them are so inert, so hopelessly dependent on the system, that they will fight to protect it.
Mr. Violent.
You're correct that courthouses have not been on the sensitive list. I know that some months ago, ICE determined to put courthouses in a special category deserving of some sort of special treatment. I agree that courthouses are special places in the nature of a church.
The question is, who are we as Americans, and who are our people?
No, we don't have a military-industrial complex.
We
you up as a citation, disorderly conduct, for offending someone.
Agenda31.org.